This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org if you're not there already. Today, I'm pleased to have in the studio with me Ray McGovern, an outspoken former CIA officer turned peace activist, author of Neocon and Neocon Again. You may have seen him on Democracy Now. You may have read his stuff on commondreams.org. I've read and read about Ray McGovern for almost a decade now, but I've never met him until today, and I'm delighted to have you in the studio with me. Ray McGovern, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thanks, Matt.
Tell me a little bit about your background. You worked for the CIA for a while. How'd that happen?
Well, I majored in Russian undergraduate, and when I got out, a new president came in. His name was Kennedy, and this may sound corny these days, but he asked everyone, you know, not to think so much about what the government could do for them, but what they might be able to do for the government. The Russians were really challenging us in those days, so I thought I'd try to turn my learnings and my interest into something conducive to helping out. So long story short, I did a graduate degree, then I did my 2 years as an Army officer, and then it was a natural transition to the CIA as an analyst of Soviet affairs.
And this was during the Vietnam War days?
It's before. This was during John Kennedy, before he got in big deep, before he got very much in. But then my account was Soviet foreign policy toward Southeast Asia, China, and the international communist movement. So I was very much in the mix there, looking at things from the communist perspective.
Mm-hmm. Jumping forward several decades, the CIA was blamed for not predicting the fall of the Soviet Union. With your background and experience, what do you make of that?
Well, it's very easily explained. A fellow came in named Bobby Gates, who actually worked for me back in the 60s.
Really?
No, I'm sorry, early 70s.
What was he like then?
Well, he was bright enough, a pretty good writer, but so incredibly ambitious that he was a disruptive influence in the branch. And I had to, on his fitness report, I had to say, you know, you're doing fine, but, you know, stop trying to get to be a division chief overnight. It didn't happen that way. And I, you know, recorded the fact that he was a disruptive influence because of his overweening ambition. And people said to me later when he became head of analysis, oh, I bet you wish you hadn't said that, right? I said, negative. Just wait. And so that's how I knew him. When Bill Casey came in under Ronald Reagan, he was a real good imaginative paymaster or spy master for World War II. But he thought that the Soviets were exactly the same as the Nazis. He saw a Soviet under every rock in Nicaragua, for example. And Bobby Gates, when he learned that, he went, Mr. Casey, I see two Soviets under those rocks. And I have a whole bunch of analysts that they'll see three and four, you know. Now, that's sort of a simplistic way of saying it, but that's not an exaggeration. So I get the job. Now, when you see little communists all over the place and when you're trying to build anti-ballistic missile systems against threats and so forth, you want to never acknowledge that the Soviet Union could change. And so what Bobby Gates did was bring in sycophants who were more interested in getting career progression than they were in the truth. And so they muffed it. They really missed it. That is the ones that were working for him. Now, there were others that acknowledged what was going to happen. I happened to be in a beautiful spot. I was briefing Secretary Shultz every other day. And so I would check with the honest Soviet analysts before I went down there and check what they said against what I knew about the Soviet Union. And I would tell Secretary Shultz exactly what we thought, the honest ones. And he's a pretty bright guy. He discerned very quickly what was going on and was very, very appreciative to be able to have a separate line from the one that he denounced later as being thoroughly unobjective and biased and should have been fired.
I'm speaking with Ray McGovern, a former CIA officer turned peace activist and critic and writer. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of The Progressive Magazine. This is Progressive Radio. When you were briefing Schultz, and then later I understand you were briefing President Reagan, were you ever worried that Reagan was so belligerent, especially when Alexander Haig was at the Defense Department, that there might have been World War III?
Well, I never briefed Reagan himself. He liked to sleep in, so we had a team of two folks, and we would brief a set of two or three of Vice President Bush, Secretary of State Schultz, Secretary of Defense Weinberger, the assistant to the to the President for National Security Affairs, that whole string of those. And then at our initiative, we asked to include the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs because we thought that he should also get the President's daily brief. So there were those five or six people that got it. The person that I had the most professional relationship with was Secretary Schultz. He knew which end was up. He was not going to be corrupted. He was wrong on some things like the threat from Central America, but I think he just sort of played along as that was a sort of a sideshow. But it was he who responded to Gorbachev, and it was largely he that recognized that there was a real, real change in the Soviet Union. And to the degree we played a role in his appreciating that, we were happy about that. And to the degree that others were able to exaggerate the Soviet threat to promote our own defense spending, we were unhappy about that. But that's nothing that we could ever control.
Now, was Gorbachev serious about total nuclear disarmament?
It's total and complete. He was indeed, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, this was the real deal. And they were close to it at Reykjavik. They were very, very close.
Wouldn't that
have been I know the guys that took Reagan aside and said, "You can't do this. You can't do this. No, it'll never work. Can't trust those Soviets." And we weren't there to tell Reagan, you don't have to trust them. You know, you can verify, trust but verify. We could have told him that. But the guys that he was listening to were these, neocons, and they saw the Soviets as a great big menace. And not incidentally, an ABM system is something that would be very lucrative for their friends. And that carried all the way down to 9/11, because that day, Condoleezza Rice had a speech prepared, and it wasn't on terrorism. It was on anti-ballistic missile defense. That was the main thrust of those early months, that and securing safe energy supplies.
Just one more question on Russia, and then we'll bring things right up to date. The standard neoconservative and right-wing Republican interpretation of the fall of the Soviet Union was that the Saint Ronald Reagan buried them with defense spending. Mm. You were professionally an analyst of the Soviet Union. What's your theory?
I think that's a terrible oversimplification. What I like to do is cite the testimony of Jack Matlock, who was ambassador to the Soviet Union when it imploded. He's about the brightest guy on the Soviet Union I ever ran into, and I've run into a lot of them. And he confessed that, it looked like it was weakening, but it was a big surprise. It was a terribly big surprise that the Soviet Union imploded the way it did. And it didn't have much to do with our defense spending. It had to do with a lot of other things. And my best guess is that it had to do with the explosion of communications, the fact that you couldn't keep the truth away from Soviet citizens, the fact that they could watch Western TV and the rest of it. And it just was not possible to keep them strained in the way they were, especially when a fellow with glasnost and perestroika comes on the scene and says, this Communist Party really needs to reform. So it was a combination of a whole bunch of events. And I think that the explanation that it was the big boost in defense spending can be shown to be largely specious.
And very convenient.
And self-serving, yeah.
And convenient not only for the Republicans who worship Ronald Reagan, but convenient for the defense contractors who made all that money and can justify it that way. Ray McGovern, it's not every person who is a CIA analyst who decides finally to break and speak out. What prompted you?
Well, it was really a straight line. When I entered the agency, the first thing I saw on the marble hallway there was a phrase from the Bible. It said, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free." And I thought, no pun intended, but if that's true, that's going to be a good place to work. And you know what? For most of those 27 years, we were able to do that. We had career protection for telling the truth. We had no, in our best days, we had no political agenda. Now, you tell people in Washington something like that, oh, right, right, their eyes glaze over, no political agenda, give me a break. But it was true. So when I saw that dissipated, you know, there was always this problem of the other agency, okay, the one that was an accident of history, the Office of Strategic Services coming home after the war saying, should we stay around? We're really good at overthrowing governments and torturing people and, you know, all this kind of stuff. Do you need us? And that question answered itself with the Soviet Union taking over Eastern Europe, the KGB all over the world. And so some idiot thought, well, we could take these covert operators and put them together with the analysts, and that would be just fine because they both deal with the sensitive information. It was a structural fault, okay, and it's never been healed. And you can see what happened when George Tenet decided that that his job was to help the president. If the president wants to make a war, well, yeah, serve up intelligence that Senator Jay Rockefeller, head of the Senate Intelligence Committee, said was unsubstantiated, contradicted, and non-existent. His words, non-existent intelligence. So when we saw that happen, and we saw it well before, we saw it right after 9/11, and it was very clear. What's the first thing that General Clark said? He was going on the TV there that night, and he called the White House. Any new information? Yeah, and this new information, it was Iraq. He says, well, Iraq? What do you mean? He says, no, say it was Iraq. And he says, what do you mean, say it? What's your evidence? Well, so Clark says, I didn't say it was Iraq because there was no evidence. Well, you know, that was the evening of 9/11. And, you know, just the way it all played out, we saw that our profession, you know, our intelligence analysis profession, you know, the doctors and the lawyers are also ashamed of what their colleagues have done. We, too, had a profession, and we saw that really the reward is not too strong, prostituted. We saw that corrupted with the deliberate intention of deceiving our elected representatives in Congress out of their constitutional prerogative to declare or otherwise authorize war. Well, it didn't get any worse than that. So we formed a small group, which we called Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. We started writing memos to the president. We did three before he attacked Iraq. We're not real happy that our predictions were borne out, but at least we were on record, ignored but on record, as calling it the way it was.
What did your former colleagues, what was their reaction to what you did? Were you ostracized? Were you called names? Or did people say you're doing the right thing? Or
you
both?
Know, there was, after the five of us set up this little movement, there were immediately about 60, 65 folks that came in from all the intelligence agencies of our government. Almost all of them retired, of course. So that was that. Now, from the inside, I would get really interesting comments, but very few. Why? Because nobody wanted to call me on the phone. Nobody wanted to send me an email.
Because it'd be on record.
And that's different. That's different, okay? That's the Patriot Act and all these other things. But every now and then I go to a concert, right? Okay, so I go into the men's room, and there's old Alec. Hey, Ray, keep up doing that stuff. You know, we share your stuff around here. Keep it up. You know, we can't say much about it, but, yeah, keep. And the wives of my – and we'd meet people at funerals lately is what we're doing. I'd meet the wives of these guys who are still pretty high officials in the CIA. They'd take me aside and say, keep on doing it. Keep on doing it. Even Peter thinks it's good, but he can't say that, of course. So, you know, it's really kind of ridiculous. Mm-hmm.
I'm speaking with Ray McGovern, outspoken former CIA officer, now peace activist and critic of U.S. foreign policy, and obviously a critic of the shenanigans that happened in the Bush-Cheney-Rumsfeld regime. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor of The Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. Let's bring her up straight to Obama. What do you make of President Obama's foreign policy?
Well, Matt, I confess to be profoundly disappointed. I had hopes, even though there were early indications that it wasn't going to be the way we had hoped it would be. But I see him as a captive of the powers that be, the people with whom he surrounded himself. Even on the economic side and the financial side, my God, you know, bringing in the very people responsible for the mess. Well, that's what he did on the military and intelligence side. I can speak to intelligence with some authority. You know, he was unwilling to dismiss the people who were responsible for the torture, the kidnapping, the keeping people in black prisons without telling their wives or their family, much less the Red Cross. I mean, when he came in, he didn't clean house. He put a guy named Panetta in there to be the agency's lawyer, okay? Not its director, to be its lawyer. And that's how he functioned. That's how he's functioning now at defense.
Well, he kept your favorite Gates there.
Well, yeah, it kept Gates on, yeah. But that was, that too was one of these too clever by half moves on the part of Obama. So it was a really bad disappointment. I was looking at something I wrote 3 years ago, July 4, 2008. Obama had just revealed that contrary to what he said before, he was going to vote for that Military Commissions Act, the FISA thing, which would authorize things that had been prohibited under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, and would hold AT&T, Verizon, all those guys harmless for monitoring our conversations, clearly illegal. And I said to myself, you know, what's going down here? This guy's a professor of law? I wonder what country he's a professor of law about, you know? And then I said, you know, how does he explain this? And you know how he explained it? The spokesman said, in effect, where else are you guys going to go? You know, you want John McCain to be president? And I said, God, that guy's no different from all the others. And that was my first warning. Of course, he seemed to be better than McCain. But, you know, when push comes to shove, McCain would be a loose cannon in there. But here we have a very controlled cannon doing the same stuff. And it's terribly disappointing to include asserting the right to assassinate U.S. citizens without due process, to include the right to start new wars without even consulting Congress. I mean, hello, the guy is a fraud.
Barack Obama, a fraud, says my guest today, Ray McGovern, on Progressive Radio. Do you think he just didn't believe in what he was saying, shutting down Guantanamo and all this other stuff, or do you think he was swayed by the people he chose, or what happened?
Well, it's anyone's guess, of course. My guess is that he did believe these things because they happen to be true and right and moral, okay? But he had no backbone, apparently, because when people came and said, well, you can't do this, or, you know, better go slow on this. And you know, those guys did torture, but, you know, don't go after them. Better look forward than back. Well, he let himself, you know, he really is, what do they call it? He's got no backbone. There's a Latin word for that.
There are a lot of Anglo-Saxon words for that, too. Let's talk about Afghanistan. You've written a lot about Afghanistan, and your background in Soviet history probably helps you understand Afghanistan better than almost anyone I've ever met. Why did Obama escalate the war in Afghanistan?
Well, again, he didn't want to be the second president to lose a war. I mean, it's the same LBJ syndrome here. Didn't want to be the first president to lose a war, and he became the first president to lose a war, Vietnam. So here's Obama saying, well, you know, this may not turn out all that well, but I can't just leave, can't stop this war. It would be politically indefensible. They went out to Petraeus, and Petraeus said, yeah, we got to make progress, and Petraeus with all his medals and so forth. I think the president felt that Petraeus was too much of a match for him. And, you know, Petraeus can give himself another row of ribbons, but the president, they can't put it on anything but an American flag on, you know. And that's not an exaggeration. So bringing Petraeus back to head the CIA is another terrible mistake on the part of Obama. But Afghanistan was always a no winner. And the WikiLeaks cables showed this very clearly. Suffice it to say that they indicated that the people running the Taliban, the people not only financing, supporting, you know, but leading the Taliban Well, Pakistani intelligence guys, you know, you see that from this ground truth, from the messages from the army. Well, the CIA made two estimates at the end of last year. One was on Afghanistan. Conclusion, Afghanistan can't be won, or we can't prevail in Afghanistan, whatever that means, unless the Pakistanis really seal off the border, okay? Second estimate, that was on Pakistan. Pakistan, the conclusion, well, to use the vernacular, there ain't a snowball's chance in hell that we're going to persuade the Pakistanis to change their strategic outlook as we indicate, you know, don't be afraid of the Indians. The Indians are very nice people. We just came from, they're very nice people. Be afraid just of terrorists, okay? It ain't going to work. The whole reason the Taliban's in Pakistan or Afghanistan is to safeguard Pakistani interests there. So the notion that Obama does what he does anyway, sends in now we have slightly less than 100,000 troops, shows that either he doesn't quite understand what's going on, or he's led to believe really stupid things by people like John Brennan, people like the neoconservatives, who think that it's really, really good for the U.S. to be involved in wars that have no real ending. And Petraeus, what does he say? Well, he always says, just like he said about Iraq, well, we're making progress, but it's tentative, it's fragile, and it's reversible. What does that mean? Give me a break. The president's going to make a decision on this progress that's fragile but reversible? You know, that's the kind of stuff that LBJ listened to. And you know what happened to LBJ.
And it's a way to box in the president.
Yeah.
I understand it's not a winnable fight over there, but I imagine there are people who are listening to this show and they're going to say, well, if the U.S. leaves, the Taliban may take over Afghanistan, and that would be worse for all the people in Afghanistan, especially women and girls. And how do you respond to that?
Well, you know, it's pretty darn bad for women and girls there now. It's really, really bad for them, okay? Now, nobody likes the Taliban, okay? But it's the perpetual war that is destroying lots of villages and so forth, midnight raids and all that kind of thing. So it's hard to conceive that it could be much worse, okay? Now, it was supposed to be Al-Qaeda that we're supposed to be going in there to disrupt, dismantle, and defeat or whatever it is, you know? Who makes these things up for the president? You know, disrupt, dismantle, sounds really good. You know, there were 50 of them there, or maybe 100, as many as 100, but probably less, 50 maybe. Well, give me a break. 100,000 troops for 50 Al-Qaeda? Taliban, what are they going to do? They hate Al-Qaeda. They come in to take care of or rule in Afghanistan, there are going to be all kinds of constraints on them, not least our ability to bomb the hell out of any camps that get reconstructed in Afghanistan. So, you know, as Paul Pillar points out, Al-Qaeda doesn't need Afghanistan. Al-Qaeda's got all kinds of places where it can set up shop and is doing. So why are we still there? Well, it has to do with natural resources. It has to do with permanent military bases. It has to do with our post-war fixation on appropriating more than our fair share of the natural resources of this world, whether they be oil, natural gas. One thing people don't realize, that right above Afghanistan in Turkmenistan lie natural gas deposits worth more than all the oil in Iraq, okay? Natural gas. What's the problem? You can't get it here from there. So, you know, there has been a pipeline envisaged and engineered and all from Turkmenistan through Afghanistan, Pakistan, a little slice of India, and a warm water port. Don't have to go through the Soviet Union. Don't have to go through the Strait of Hormuz. I mean, you got it made when you get that kind of... Who is going to market this stuff? A little firm named Enron, you know? Talk about corruption. Talk about what the real aims here are. And you'll see, if you look closely enough, except you won't see it in what I call the fawning corporate media.
And why the corporate media just doesn't explain this? Because they've got a corporate interest, or they want to play ball with whoever's in power?
Well, many of the outlets, many of the cable stations, or most of them, are owned by corporations that are profiteering on these wars. Profiteering, not profiting. So it's pretty basic, pretty easily understood. Eisenhower warned about it. It's come to full fruition now.
Ray McGovern's my guest today on Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild, your host. You wrote a column recently, Ray McGovern, that said... U.S. soldiers dying in Afghanistan, specifically the 30 who died in that helicopter crash, died in vain. It was a bold statement. Do you want to explain it and why you decided to use that?
Well, I think that very few people are willing to face up to the reality here. There's a poverty draft. We're drafting young kids from towns in this country of less than 50,000 and from the inner cities. That's where most of our troops are coming, where there's no economic opportunity, no educational opportunity. They're sort of forced into the army. And then we send them out to places like Afghanistan and not only have them brutalize others, but let them get them brutalized themselves. Now, that's got to stop. And the only way it's going to stop is to people be frank about what's going on. 1% of Americans are touched in any way by this war. That ain't right. That's the first time in our history that that's been the case. One of the worst things, in my view, that Nixon did was abolish the draft. And I know that I'm probably an outlier on that, but I could see what was coming. I mean, I served in the draft army, okay? I served with doctors, lawyers, Indian chiefs, and all manner of folks. It was a great, great experience. Now, it's quite a different army. And it's not the kind of army that our founders had in mind, because they perpetually said, no standing army. You have a standing army, professionals, you're going to find wars to fight, okay? So, I guess the whole notion of calling these folks heroes, well, not heroes, they're victims, trying to con their families into believing that this was a worthy cause. You know, it's taken me several years to say it this bluntly, but Cindy Sheehan said it almost just months after her son Casey was killed. And you'll recall she went to Crawford, Texas to ask George Bush, what was this worthy cause, his words, for which her son died? There ain't no worthy cause, and the people in America needs to know that. And the mass media are not going to tell them that, because they're profiteering from the war. Somebody's got to tell them, and I figured maybe this was the time when 30 got killed, and there's going to be more. And the problem is, of course, when there are more, then Obama will be told, well, you can't let these people have died in vain. Well, you know, give me a break. They did die in vain, okay? And there's no escaping that.
But the phrase itself perpetuates war. I mean, mm-hmm. It just keeps the cycle going and going. Yeah. To make sure that they didn't die in vain, you got to go kill more people, and more people are going to get killed. So we got to make sure they don't die in vain. And there's no end to that craziness.
Yeah. And, you know, it takes mothers, I'm convinced, to really appreciate that in an immediate way. That's why I admire Cindy Sheehan to such a great degree. There's no closer bond than a mother and a child. And when they see duplicity, the stronger of them, and where they're unwilling to settle for injustice and lies, then they come forward. And one of the things I've observed in these last 10 years has been the women that have been leading the charge here, the Code Pink women, Cindy Sheehan's, the others who have said, no, this is wrong, and we're going to stand up, we're going to say it like it is.
Hats off to the women who've been leading the activism. I agree with that. And unfortunately, we're out of time. I want to thank you for being my guest today. My guest has been Ray McGovern. He is an outspoken former CIA officer, now a very strong peace activist. You can read his stuff often at commondreams.org. Ray McGovern, thanks so much for being with me today.
You're most welcome, Matt.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.